You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 376 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Blue Beetle number 7, Batman number 145, Birds of Prey number 7, Poison Ivy number 20, Shazam number 9, and Bodies, season 1, episode 7, Catch Me If You Can. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. Alright, Cletus, first up for DC news. Peacemaker season 2 begins filming with John Cena and James Gunn's first behind-the-scenes image, which I thought was pretty cool because it was basically a picture of James Gunn taking a picture of the back of Peacemaker's helmet, but you could see him reflected in it taking the picture.
Drew, I'm very excited by this news, but also a little surprised because I guess I was under the misunderstanding that this wasn't going to really get rolling until after Superman was done.
Yes, I was confused by that myself because I thought the same thing because I thought we talked about it on DC News. And when I saw that the filming began, I was like, really? I don't think they're done filming Superman yet.
There's no way they are. That just started filming not that long ago. I feel like less than a month ago.
I wonder if somebody else is directing Peacemaker then.
Right, which that's not surprising because I don't think Gunn directed every single episode. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, Drew. I know he directed most of them, but I don't think he did all of them.
That may be true. I know he wrote all of them.
Yes. I don't take this as a complaint. I'm thrilled. I just was not news that I was expecting.
Me either. So I guess we should be expecting it a little sooner than we thought, which is cool. All right. And for our last bit of DC news, Joker Folia Dur gets an official trailer. And I don't know what I think about it.
I'm excited to check out the second one, Drew. I found myself essentially in the same boat as when the first one came out, which is I have a hard time wrapping my head around it being good until it was. The first one was good, and the trailer for the second one, it seemed like it could be pretty good. I still have a lot of doubts that they can catch that magic twice, Drew. Joker did not seem like a film that would have a very obvious follow-up film to it. The director deserves a lot of credit, Drew. He made an Oscar award-winning film that kind of came out of nowhere, if you look at the guy's resume, though. And so the fact that we're doubling down on him, I have a lot of doubts, Drew, but I don't know that they're founded because it worked the first time. And like I said, the trailer didn't look like a disaster. I don't know, man. I think it's probably the most fascinating thing to me about this franchise is that it feels sort of inexplicable. Like, it's probably one of the more successful things that DC has done, really, when you think about it from both a box office and critical perspective. Batman was fairly well received, too, but nobody was really expecting it, I don't think. I think people were mostly expecting the opposite, and yet here we are. I don't know. I feel like there's a decent chance, Drew, that this one also succeeds, especially when you've got Gaga playing Harley Quinn. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's the thing that I find most fascinating is that this is somehow going to be probably one of DC's more successful franchises that they've done other than Batman in a while. And I don't think anybody expects any success from it.
This is one movie that I've been pessimistic about too. So I was about the first one. I'm kind of about this one too. But like you said, the trailer looks like it's kind of, to me, it kind of looks like it's trying to replicate what it did the first time, but in a different way. And I'm curious. I'm not going to be able to make a decision about it until I actually see it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Can they replicate what they did the first time?
Yeah, I don't know. And that's the thing. Can they replicate it without it feeling just like this, the first film again? Which this guy, again, this director, I think one of the films he's probably most known for before this was the Hangover series. And regardless of what you think of the film, financially, the first Hangover film was a success. And then the second one, personally, for me, wasn't very good because it was just the first film again. Like it basically hit every scene. You felt like I was like, well, I could just rewatch The Hangover. Like I don't need to watch this movie. And I do wonder, that's been one of the things that's been on my mind, Drew, since they announced this, is like, well, he's kind of had a crack at a sequel before. I know it was an extremely different kind of film. I understand that. But they basically didn't innovate at all. They literally tried to hit all of the same beats again, and obviously to diminishing returns because you've already seen it once. And like you said, there's hints in the trailer that there's the chance that that's what this film is too. We don't know. I mean, again, this is pure speculation on our part, but it wouldn't shock me, Drew, if we sit down and watch this and I feel like it's just trying to redo the first movie. That wouldn't surprise me. But there's also a few things in the trailer that, like you said, make it seem like they're trying to do it in a little bit of a different way, hit some different notes. It seems really likely that there's going to be a musical number at some point in it to me, which would make sense. I don't know. And it feels like maybe we're going to do a different spin on the Harley Quinn and Joker relationship. I think that, Drew, I'm not the lone in this opinion. I don't want to act like I'm coming up with it. There's some speculation that we might see kind of that relationship spun on its head with Harley having more of the power dynamic in it, which would be kind of interesting.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Now, one of the things I noticed in the trailer was Joker says, somebody asked Joker what's changed, and he says, I'm not alone anymore. That's one thing that stuck out to me. Then the other thing that stuck out to me is Harley makes this smiley face on the glass, and then you see Joker's lips like come up to it, and then he makes this smile. It looks really creepy.
The cinematography really stood out to me, Drew. That shot in particular was very impressive, which again, that was the thing. Like as I was watching it, I was like, this doesn't look like a train wreck. It might not be as good as the first one, but there were some really good cinematic shots in the trailer. And again, that's not to say that the whole film will be good or bad or whatever. We don't know. But man, I just have that feeling in my gut, Drew, like they're somehow gonna pull it off again, and I just don't I can't understand it. There's nothing about this franchise that feels like it should work.
I won't argue with you on that. All right, well, that wraps up DC News for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
Check out the Modern Musicology podcast, where each week we talk about things like
what makes a great drummer,
our favorite rock documentaries,
songs we love by artists we don't love,
our favorite concert memories,
songs that should have been singles,
and all of our favorite music from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and now.
Do not use Modern Musicology if you're allergic to it. Modern Musicology may produce itching, dizziness, vertigo, temporary blindness, or heart palpitations. Do not taunt Modern Musicology.
Ask your doctor about switching to Modern Musicology.
All right, monkeying around. Look at the picture and tell me what you see.
I see a sitcom whose cast became a real band.
Whose creators were founding members of the new Hollywood movement.
This is obviously a bunny and a chicken.
Looks like a band who sold 75 million records.
And who should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
It's a bunny and a chicken.
Four consecutive number one albums.
A bunny and a chicken.
Two Emmy Awards.
A bunny and a chicken.
Monkeying around.
A bunny and a chicken.
Podcast about the monkeys.
A bunny and a chicken.
And we're back. But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers.
Spoilers.
For you. For you.
All right, let's talk. Blue Beetle number 7. Booster Gold has summoned Jaime to help him find Ted Kord. Ted was experimenting with the time sphere and got chopped up in the time stream. He's everywhere and nowhere at once. Booster needs Jaime to activate a time anchor at 3 aligned moments in time so they can triangulate and recompose Ted. Their first stop on their trip through time is the Justice League International Embassy. Booster tells Jaime the first anchor point should be inside. Hiding behind the corner of the building is Ambush Bug. Ambush Bug reports back to an unknown person who states they need Jaime alone. Inside the Justice League International Embassy, Jaime runs into Maxwell Lord, who believes that Jaime is just an autograph hound. Jaime sets the anchor and then leaves quickly, thanking Mr. Lord for the autograph tips. The next stop in time is in the future. The Legion is battling the Dominion. Jaime transforms into Blue Beetle and lends a hand by creating a giant sledgehammer and hitting the Dominion from behind. Jaime quickly sets another anchor point and then returns to the Time Sphere. The Green Lantern Gnort is asked if he is able to extract the Blue Beetle. As Gnort watches the Time Sphere speed away, he replies that there were too many people around. The final stop is in El Paso, Jaime's childhood home. Jaime runs into his mother, who is heading to work. Jaime has a heart-to-heart talk with her. Down the street, the Heckler reports that Jaime is not alone. Heckler is told not to act because they could risk impacting the time stream. After his mom leaves for work, Jaime sets the last time anchor and then disappears. Heckler reports that Jaime has left. Booster and Jaime are traveling through the time stream when suddenly Lobo attacks. Lobo grabs Jaime, stating the boss is expecting you. Lobo brings Jaime before Joni DC, the continuity cop. She gives Jaime a citation for having a confusing origin story. She tells him to keep the retcons to a minimum and then sends him on his way. Booster and Jaime return to the present to find Ted Kord has returned. Ted tells Jaime that dark things are coming that make the Blood Scarab seem like chump change in comparison. Palmyra City. Roma has had enough of the superhero life and wants her old life back. She meets with Victoria Kord and asks her to get rid of the Green Beetle. Next issue, Horizon's End.
Drew, the DC continuity thing felt like a middle finger to everybody reading that because they didn't do anything with it. It was like I don't know how to fill the next 5 pages of the comic, so I'm going to slap in some metafictional BS. And with no point, Drew, what did that accomplish? It's a metafictional moment that does nothing other than like, yeah, there's a lot of mumbo jumbo about what your origin is. But I don't even think Blue Beetle's that confusing compared to some other ones like Hawkman, for example, is all over the place. Jaime Reyes' origin is very consistent and clear. Now, yes, I understand it can be potentially confusing because there are multiple Blue Beetles. But to be frank, Drew, and you know this, you know who the only people are that are even aware that there are multiple Blue Beetles? People who read the comics. Like, the people who don't know that aren't reading Blue Beetle. It didn't accomplish anything, Drew. There was no payoff to that. It was just like a, look at, we're doing metafictional stuff. Hey, look, see, it's the DC logo, but it's got a face on it. To what end, Drew? There was no plot resolution to that point. That was just lazy.
And a waste of time.
I genuinely mean it. That was such a lazy slap in the face to readers because it was so clearly a, I don't know what to do, so I'm going to come up with something silly and goofy and frankly distract the reader from the fact that I don't have a full 22-page comic story to tell. That's ridiculous, Drew. That is such an insult to people who are spending overpriced money to buy a single-issue comic to read this garbage that you clearly as an author don't care about. Like, I can't think of anything more obvious about, hey, I don't give a flying crap what I'm writing about as long as DC keeps cashing the checks for me. This was just an insult, Drew. I have huge problems with Josh Williamson, but not even he has stooped to this kind of crap. This was ridiculous.
Now you're wishing we would have dropped the issue. Dropped the series last time like they suggested.
I just couldn't believe it had nothing to do with anything. Like, it just, it drops the plot for a side story that it brought Ted back in possibly the most confusing way possible, because they never really, I didn't feel, did a great job explaining what the hell happened to Ted. So the ultimate point of this sidestep is that Ted Kord's alive again. I don't know that we needed that, Drew. I think we all just sort of, it's comic books. I think we all just assumed Ted was going to pop up again in a story later, right? The artwork was god-awful because it kept flipping from artist to artist to artist, and it was sort of trying to be different artists depending on what, like, time period they were in, But really, again, this was laziness of like, we don't know what to do for this issue, so here's a bunch of garbage that we're going to slop together and make you pay, what, $6 or $7 for this. People paid money for this issue. It's outrageous.
I'm not going to argue with you on that. And I wasn't expecting that great of a rant from you. Man, that was good. All right. So are we agreed we're going to drop this title now?
Please.
Don't worry. It's not going to end up on our list again. All right. Moving on to our next title for this week. Batman number 145. Even though Zurin R broke Joker's back, he is happy that Bruce Wayne is in jail with him, spiraling. Joker looks forward to breaking the true Batman. Bat-Zur blows up a semi-truck full of weapons and takes down the villains hard. He lets one of them go to spread the word that Batman is back. Red Hood contacts Oracle to tell her that he is almost at the warehouse. Oracle tells him that he should be resting because adrenaline spikes still trigger the fear responses that Batman conditioned him with. Jason counters that the dose of Joker toxin he received in The Joker, The Man Who Stopped Laughing, number 12, has helped to counter it. Red Hood arrives to find Bat-Zur at the scene. Jason believes it is Failsafe, but Zur tells him it's Bruce. He hunted down Failsafe and beat him once and for all. It cost him, though, and left his body broken. He uploaded his consciousness to Failsafe's body. Jason comes at Bat-Zur with knives, but Bat-Zur stops him easily, grabbing him by the neck. Bat-Zur tells Jason he won't hurt him anymore unless he breaks the law. Bat-Zur drops him to the ground and he jumps away. Bruce Wayne takes pieces of metal from Joker's back brace and uses them to pick the lock of his jail cell. Using bandages, Bruce creates a mask for himself to hide his identity as he makes his way out of the lower levels of Blackgate. Bruce comes across Vandal Savage in a prison cell and learns that Zur had taken over the mansion and the cave. Vandal tells him that the law will help him regain what is his. Moments later, Bruce is attacked by robots Failsafe used to secure the city. They zap Bruce with electricity, knocking him unconscious. Bat-Zur makes an announcement to the city of Gotham via their cell phones and other media. He states that evil's day is numbered and that Batman is back. Using the announcement as a distraction, Bat-Zur is able to take down the Riddler. Chris Nakano, the current mayor of Gotham, calls Commissioner Montoya and tells her that he is getting pressure from outside forces. They want change and doesn't know how much longer he can protect her. Robin Damian Wayne confronts Bat-Zur, asking if it is really his father. Zur answers it is. Damian asks him to prove it. Bat-Zur tells him a personal story about a time he moved into the mansion and had nightmares. Bruce would sit in his room until he drifted off to sleep. Damian believes that Bat-Zur is his father. The rest of the Bat family has gathered at the clock tower. Nightwing states they need to get to the bottom of what has happened before it's too late. Blackgate. Bruce Wayne receives a visit from Daniel Captio, his old mentor, who states that the Batman of Zurin R has made him warden of Blackgate. To be continued. We also had a backup story called Doctor's Orders. Joker, who is clearly obsessed with Zurin R, kills his therapist and breaks out of Arkham. This is in the early days. Joker heads to an abandoned house where he is keeping Dr. Captio prisoner. Dr. Captio tells the Joker that if he wants to see the Zurin R persona again, he'll need to create emergencies. The Joker heads to Wayne Manor while Dr. Captio waits patiently to see the results. This is what Dr. Captio wanted, a chance to study these two superhuman minds.
Drew, one thing I found interesting with the backup is it felt like the plot of what was going would have normally been the next issue. When it ended off with to be continued next time and then continued, I was like, wait, this feels like the what would be continued with a little present mixed in, obviously, if it was the main comic. But and that's not a complaint, but it felt like I had got like an advance on the next issue as I was reading, because it was very much just for like you kind of have to read the backup, I feel like. And I'm sure almost anybody who buys this is going to read the backup, obviously, but this felt extremely necessary to read. And again, I'm aware most people will, but extremely relevant to the plot, like essentially just an extension of the main plot. And I don't mean that as criticism necessarily, but it just kind of surprised me how relevant it was.
Yeah, I went right along with the story, so I don't know. The thing I like about this issue is the fact that I coined the term Batzer. Copyright pending. I thought this was an okay issue. I mean, it pretty much felt the same old after the Joker origin that, you know, we're getting back to. Yeah. And I'm just not into the storyline that much.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't think this was an actively bad issue by any means, but I'm not super into the story. Really don't like an unmasked Batman chilling in a jail cell with Joker chumming it up. And I know that's an exaggeration, but that's not my taste in Batman stories.
The other thing is, what's the point of Vandal Savage having the mansion? They haven't done anything with that except stick him in a jail cell.
I know. Honestly, Drew, that plot point felt like a reminder to the reader, like, hey, FYI, this is a story that I'm going to do in like a year or so. Don't forget. Because there's no story that showed that capture or anything. It felt very casual, like, oh, yeah, they've got Vandal Savage under arrest right now. But FYI, hey, still owns the mansion. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it really just felt like a reminder to the reader.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that. I am happy to see that the Bat family is getting involved. I'm surprised they haven't been involved sooner. I know he's probably wanting to keep them out of it for now so he can tell his story, but honestly, I think they should have gotten involved sooner.
I also can't say that I'm frothing at the mouth to read a story in which Vandal Savage owns Wayne Manor.
I'm not either, honestly. We know it's going to come at some point. I don't know. I'm just not happy with the run right now. We've got it into some stuff I'm just not interested in. Not saying that it's bad, but it's just stuff I don't want to read.
Yeah. Not to my taste. I agree.
All right. Well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Birds of Prey number 7. Gotham. Barbara Gordon examines the data that was provided by Meridian and learns that her tech uses the green to allow her to teleport and time travel. Whoever this mystery person is that has been murdering Barbara has been using the red to time travel. Batgirl Cassandra Cain and Big Barda have decided to stay on the team working with Sin. One part training and one part observation. MJM Enterprises. Barbara and Dinah pay a visit to Mari McCabe, a.k.a. Vixen. Mari offers a trade since she is having a problem of her own. People with no previous records or any red flags are being arrested for wearing her clothes brand. This has been happening for the last 2 months. Mari explains that 2 weeks ago, she herself woke up in the middle of committing a robbery. If it wasn't for the fact that she was skilled and had powers, she would have been arrested herself. Barbara believes this could possibly be tied to their own problem since Mari has been a bird of prey and may be targeted for that reason. What other reason does anyone have for targeting all these people except for revenge by trying to destroy Mari's fashion empire? Vixen comes up with a plan and heads downtown with Dinah, Meridian, Cassandra, and Barda. They put on a fashion show in their underwear to bring out the mysterious villain. Next issue. Well, they're already in their underwear. What else could you possibly want? Cletus, I had to go back and see who wrote this. I was like, is some guy writing this? Nope, it was written by a woman. I was like, okay.
You know, Drew, you know the thing that I feel like tips it off that it's written by a woman is that it's very tongue-in-cheek about the whole thing. It's very sort of knowing and not just doing it as if that's a normal thing. I think that's the difference in it. The comic knows what it is doing and is poking fun at it. And like I said, it's very tongue-in-cheek. Especially that last bit at the end. They're already in underwear. What more do you want? Like, it's like, yeah, okay. This was good, Drew. I really liked this issue. And getting the explanation sort of loosely of how Mia's powers are, time travel powers are tied to the green is really interesting. And I'm kind of curious to see where this plot goes. I'm very interested. I just am so impressed by this Birds of Prey title so far, Drew. Once again, I do think the artist paired with the writer is doing a lot of work. The writer's good, don't get me wrong. She's done a great job crafting this story, but the artist has been so good. The one issue we had where we didn't have this artist was easily my least favorite issue of the run so far.
I'm enjoying this title too, and I'm curious too. I like the fact that Meridian's power is tied to the green also, and I find it interesting that the villain could be using the red. So, you know, I'm intrigued by that mystery and who could possibly be the villain. I'm interested in that plot point. And then I like the fact that they kept on Barda and Cassandra Cain as Birds of Prey going forward. I don't know for how long, but I find it interesting. And I like the lineup of the team. And I'm glad Barbara's back because, you know, she was one of the original Birds of Prey. So when we were reading the first story arc and she wasn't in it, it felt like she got slighted. But their whole reason why she wasn't on the team makes total sense. And I like that was the reason behind it, is because she kept getting murdered. So very interesting. I'm excited to see where this goes. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Poison Ivy number 20. Seattle waterfront years ago. The plants that Professor Woodrue taught to listen could now move as well. Pam struggles to keep them under control and is frustrated at losing precious work time. Professor Woodrue shows up and wants Pam to steal more supplies from the university. Pam notices a rash on Professor Woodrue's neck and asks him if he is dosing himself with the plant stuff. Professor Woodrue denies it, stating he must convince their funders in Gotham to front another $500,000. Pam returns to the university a few days later to discover a new student, Bella Garten, one she discovers is better at everything and that Professor Woodrue has taken an interest in. It is not long before Bella is brought to the secret lab. Soon, Pam had to share the space, the resources, and the ideas. It wasn't easy because the shipping container was pretty snug for three people. Pam and Bella fought a lot. Pam ended up hating Bella so much that she ended up wanting her. It wasn't long before they shared a kiss and became lovers. They agreed not to tell Professor Woodrue, ever. Pam and Bella begin working together in the secret lab, but things get weird. Professor Woodrue begins to suspect something as his two star pupils that he has tried so hard to create a rivalry between suddenly have secrets, and he hated it. Soon, Bella discovers that Pam has been sleeping with Professor Woodrue. Pam states it's been going on so long that she doesn't know how to stop it. Bella states she's not angry with Pam, but angry that they have to put up with Professor Woodrue's creepy behavior in order to do what they love. Bella reveals that she has been doing her own secret experiments. If she could get her own funding, then they could escape Woodrue and his god complex. Pam gets angry when she learns that Bella has mixed plant and chimpanzee genes. Pam doesn't understand how this can advance medical science. Bella states that Woodrue isn't doing his experiments to advance medical science. He wants fame, money, and power for himself. Professor Woodrue overhears the women talking and berates Bella for not experimenting on her own body as he has. Seeing an opportunity to finally do something better than Bella, Pam agrees to let Professor Woodrue experiment on her. Next issue, Origin of Species, the final chapter.
Drew, I really enjoyed this issue. I've been very much enjoying this new take on Pamela's origin as Poison Ivy and involving the other scientist this issue who we saw pop up during, I believe it was Rom V's run, if I'm correct, Drew, right? Not in Probably. Poison Ivy, but in Catwoman. When Ivy was two separate characters, we had another
woman
pop up, and it was that woman.
Yes, it was. I'm glad you reminded me of that, because I was wondering where I'd seen her before. That was it.
I may be wrong on who. I swear she was in Catwoman, but maybe it was something else too. But that was it was really cool. Because I initially didn't put it together, and then it took me a few pages, and I was like, oh, that's who you are. So that was really cool, incorporating her into the story again, you know, giving, updating and modernizing the origin. I can't wait for the next issue of this to kind of wrap up this origin mini arc. It's been really good. It's been really, really good. I have a feeling that this origin is going to stick around for a while.
I have to agree with you. It is really good, and I can see it sticking around for a while too. It's really detailed, which I like. I mean, earlier in the series, we got a brief origin for Pamela, but I like how this one's fleshed out. There's a story going on. We've kind of hit the pause on that to do this flashback of her origin. And I like the origin story, and I'm interested to see how it plays back into what's going on with her in the present. Because I have a feeling it's going to tie together. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. All right, well, let's move on to our last issue for this week, Shazam number 9, Philadelphia's Fawcett City neighborhood. The Creeper sneaks past the security guard and takes Cam 3 West offline and then wipes its hard drive. Jack Ryder interviews Billy Batson on his On the Road Visiting National show. Jack asks him questions about his podcast, The Captain, and his recent change of stories to Metamorpho. Jack bets The Captain brings in more revenue than Metamorpho ever did. After the show, Jack offers Billy a ride home. As they're driving, Billy asks about some cards that Jack uses for vocal exercises before every show. He asks Billy to try them by speaking them as fast as possible. As Billy is reading them out loud, he says the word Shazam and transforms. Jack's suspicions are confirmed. Jack reveals that he has footage of Billy transforming in front of St. Joseph's Hospital security cam. Jack states that he has an AI program that searches security systems for anything interesting. When it finds something, it pings him. Jack states that Billy's secret is safe because he wiped the footage from its files before anyone could notice. Jack transforms into the Creeper, asking the Captain for his help. The Creeper takes the Captain aboard a train that is full of shadow people. These people were taken hostage by a villain known as the Shadow Thief. He is demanding a ransom of a half trillion in untraceable crypto. The Captain helps the Creeper take down the Shadow Thief. The Captain is unable to land a punch on Shadow Thief because he is intangible with special gloves that allow him to touch the physical world. Shadow Thief derails the train, and the Captain must stop it before it crashes. Using his magic lightning, Billy transforms, letting the lightning hit Shadow Thief. Now tangible, the Creeper pounces on him. Once Shadow Thief's shadow gizmo is deactivated, the shadow people are returned to normal. Jack Ryder returns home. When he opens the front door, Metamorpho spills out of a bucket above him, soaking him. Metamorpho states, "Who you calling souffle face?" Next issue, Full House. I read this issue, Cletus, and I'm like, what happened to the alien thing that was in the cabinet? We kind of skipped over that. I'm guessing that we're probably going to revisit that at some time. But I was expecting a Mr. Tawny creature in the cabinet story, and instead we got the Creeper. Which, I'm not a big fan of the Creeper, but this was an okay story. It had a couple funny moments in it.
Yeah, I agree. It had a few good moments in it for sure. I haven't read a lot of Creeper stories, Drew. Obviously, we just read the Danger Street story that heavily involves that character, though I wouldn't say that that is a prototypical portrayal of the Creeper. Again, this is ignorance on my part, not criticism of Wade, but I was having a hard time kind of... I don't understand the character well enough to know, Drew, is the craziness of the Creeper also supposed to be an act, or is when he's wearing his human suit, so to speak, is it like Batman and Bruce Wayne level of like the real him is the Creeper in terms of like level of sanity, or you know what I mean, or is it somewhere in between? And I felt like Wade was trying to potentially play around with that a little bit and make you question that, but this is not criticism, but more me just wondering and wanting to learn, like, what is the real version of him, if that makes sense? Like, is the level of insanity of the Creeper put on? Is that really him? Is it a Jekyll and Hyde type thing? What are we dealing with here?
From my experience, it's more like a Jekyll and Hyde, I think. But I can't honestly tell you because I don't know that much about the Creeper either. I've only seen him in stories as a guest appearance in like Batman or something, you know, something. I've never actually like read a Creeper.
Just the Creeper.
I've never read a Creeper
like
focused.
A lot of Jack Ryder. I said, I agree with you. I feel like when in the like cameos that I've seen of him, it's usually just the Creeper. So you're not getting the juxtaposition of Jack Ryder and the Creeper.
Yeah, you're right. And a lot of times when I see him, he is just the Creeper. And he's usually laughing hysterically and acting crazy. So I don't know. I've just never been impressed with him because I've always seen him as a hero version of the Joker.
Yes, I would agree. And I thought Wade kind of portrayed him like that too.
Yeah, he did. And I'm just not interested in a hero version of the Joker. So I've never really been interested in the Creeper, which is why I thought this was a mediocre story, because it wasn't for me.
One thing I was of note was we saw probably the most dramatic instance yet of the Captain and Billy becoming separate personas that they were in the original comics. This comic felt like the strongest kind of step forward we've seen yet, where they felt almost completely different people. I don't personally like that. I like Shazam or the Captain or whatever you want to call him being big in tights, as they called it, you know, in the lead up to the movie. I like that. I think it makes him stand out more. He feels a little bit more unique in that it's essentially a man child. But that's entirely subjective. And I know that there is not an insignificant amount of people who are very excited that we're going back to old school Captain Marvel, where he is his own person that Billy turns into. And I'm happy that people are getting that taste of that version again, because it's obviously been quite a while since that's been the norm. I don't personally love it, though. And so I was left not completely satisfied by the comic, and that's not really fair because it's not doing anything wrong. It's just not my personal preference for how that character is portrayed.
Yeah, I think you're going to be disappointed the rest of the series.
I've already come to terms with that, Drew. It's just, and I think that's where some of the disappointment is coming from, Drew, is that this is easily one of the better Shazam runs we've had, at least since the backups that Geoff Johns was doing in Justice League in the New 52, if not before that. It's really good. It's a consistent Shazam book that we're getting, with consistent Shazam stories that feels like that character and feels like those stories. And it feels like we're finally getting what we want, and then I'm not quite getting the flavor that I want. And I know that there are a lot of other people that have been feeling how I felt, you know, in the previous era where Billy was the same person. So it's only fair. And I don't think Wade is doing the wrong thing. It's just, it's that like bittersweet, Drew. We're like, it's like, oh my gosh, we're finally getting an ongoing that we've been wanting for, that we've been asking for years. And it's not quite the Captain Marvel that I like. And it's like, come on.
It doesn't bother me as much because I'm used to the old style Captain Marvel too. So I've had both flavors, and I don't prefer one over the other. So, you know, I'm just happy to have Captain Marvel back. I'm going to go ahead and call him that. All right. Well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk bodies.
As the temperatures get cooler, let's think back to a time where monsters fascinated our young minds, where haunted houses and flying saucers were the stuff of fantastical dreams. Come relive those wonderful times with us every Monday at 5 p.m. It's Monster Attack on the ESO Network.
We cordially invite you to experience the Soulforge podcast.
On Soulforge, we chat about movies, books, and pop culture.
Sex, love, and dating.
Travel and adventure.
Mental health issues.
We have interviews with musicians, authors, entrepreneurs, and other random weirdos. Join Sean
and Leah
and the occasional animal interruption on the Soulforge podcast.
Be a better human with the Soulforge podcast.
And we're back. Let's talk bodies. Season 1, Episode 7, Catch Me If You Can. 1889. Elias Mannix wakes up in a hospital. He sees a plaque stating that this ward is dedicated to Sir Julian Harker. Lost in battle, 1886. Brave beloved son to Lady Agatha Harker. Lady Harker is summoned to the hospital. When she looks upon Elias's face, he calls her mother. Lady Harker states that she was told her son gave his life to save his men at Mandalay. Elias answers that he would have if they had let him. Elias explains that the Burmese took him captive. He managed to escape and made his way home. He wanted to surprise his mother, but he got robbed and shot in the knee. Lady Harker grabs him by the face and exclaims, "My son!" Lady Harker brings Elias home to Harker House. She tells them that she has very little money. Elias states that he will get her money, and if she will allow it, he will love her like a son. He'll protect her. He'll build a great and glorious future that she will help him create. Elias further promises to turn this old house into a home. They will have a family. She will be a grandmother. He will marry a policeman's daughter. Elias asks her if she wants this. She answers, "Yes, Julian." 1890. Long Harvest Lane. Julian Harker hides in an alcove. Suddenly, there is a flash of light, and Professor Defoe appears. Mannix states, and so it begins. Henry Ash rounds the corner and shouts, "A man has been shot." He starts taking pictures. After church, a boy steals Polly's locket right off her neck. Sir Julian Harker trips the boy and retrieves Polly's locket. Polly recognizes him from church, and Julian states she played very well compared to his mother. Polly offers to play for Julian and his mother. Polly comes to Harker House and plays piano for the Harkers. Lady Harker falls asleep, and Polly snoops around and finds a painting of Professor Defoe. Julian explains that the body just appeared in the lane, and the artist decided to paint it. Because Lady Harker is getting up in age, and because it brings her joy, Julian hires Polly to keep playing for his mother on a permanent basis. After his father is arrested, Polly goes to Sir Julian for help. Hillinghead gets moved to Pentoville. On the way there, the carriage stops and Sir Julian enters. Hillinghead wants to know what Harker wants from him. Harker replies, "Your daughter. I will love her with all my heart as you loved Henry." Hillinghead states that if Harker touches his daughter, he will kill him. Harker responds, stating that he cannot allow Hillinghead to jeopardize his plan. "Know that you are loved." Hillinghead is killed. Sir Julian returns to Harker House and informs Polly that her father was afraid to face justice and took his own life. 2053. Detective Maplewood is asked where Commander Mannix is. She states she does not know. She is promoted to Detective Inspector Maplewood. She is asked one final question. Commander Mannix believes Sahara Hassan to be the leader of Chapel Perilous, yet her body has not been discovered. They want to know if Detective Maplewood knows where she is. Detective Maplewood answers that she never saw her. Detective Maplewood returns home. She finds Professor Defoe's leather bag in her apartment. She finds a paper that states Professor Defoe might be coming back. Detective Maplewood goes to her brother's house, where she has taken Sahara to recover. Detective Maplewood tells her that she regrets shooting Defoe and that he might be coming back. July 22, 2053. Defoe returns. Detective Maplewood's brother has made a special helmet for Defoe so he can survive. 1890 and beyond. Sir Julian Harker and Polly Hillinghead are married and have a child, a boy named Hayden Harker. Now that their son is born, Julian Harker states it is time for Polly to know the truth. Julian shows Polly the body of Professor Defoe. Julian states that he knows the future because he is from the future. Polly realizes that her husband is not Julian Harker. Julian reveals that his name is Elias Mannix. Hayden will grow up and he'll have children, and their children will have children, and one of them will be Elias's father. If Elias doesn't exist, then neither does their son. It's a loop with no beginning and no end. 1941. Polly tells Elias that White Man is hiding the girl in his flat. Elias tells Polly she knows what needs to be done. "Know you are loved, Polly." Elias records his last record. Detective White Man is hung for his crimes. 2053. Defoe states that they are part of the loop. Everything they did directly caused what has already happened. They can't stop the bomb. They can't kill Mannix. Reality prevents chains, prevents paradoxes. Mannix died full of regret. Detective Maplewood thinks they can use this. Detective Maplewood thinks they can use that to change his mind. Detective Maplewood travels back in time.
Drew, I like both bits of the episode that we got, where most of it was sort of filling in the gaps of the stuff that we didn't see, that the show had sort of implied was going on in the background, seeing how Polly becomes Harker's wife and, you know, continues the line, so to speak. One thing I was a little unsatisfied with, Drew, was that she does not seem on board when they finally clue her in to what the scheme is. And then the next time we see her, it's her as an old woman right before she goes and kills the little girl. So she is clearly fully bought in by that point, Drew. And that was, it stood out because so much of the episode was filling in the gaps. And then all of a sudden it was like, "Oh yeah, by the way, now she's the old lady." And I was like, "Wait, I need one more step. You got to show me one more step." And I'm sure that that doubt that she has there is probably going to get played on in the next episode. I feel very confident in that. But that was my one little complaint, was I was like, I love that we're filling in the gaps here, but then it feels like there's a really major one that we just sort of like yada yada away, and that wasn't super satisfying. What I also liked, Drew, was that in addition to filling in the gaps of the story that we didn't get yet. That wasn't what the whole episode was, because that would have frankly been a little bit frustrating, because we're right at the end. And I wouldn't want what wouldn't have been a filler episode by any means, but sort of just filling in the gaps is not what I want narratively. Like, I want to see what's going to happen. Like, where are we going next? How are they going to try and stop this? Where's, you know, where's the resolution going? And I like that the other part of this is what we got, you know, harkening back all the way to when we learned about time travel at the beginning of the show, this idea that it shoots back, but it also shoots forward, which is something I've been kind of waiting for the show to pay off for a while. And I thought was going to come up with Mannix slash Harker's time travel. I thought his jump, I thought that was how he was in the future initially, was that he also had shot forward in the future. That was clearly wrong. But I was glad that that got payoff, and that is how is the impetus for how potentially, maybe, the loop is going to get destroyed in the next episode. That was important, I thought, that they also included the, like, hey, this is the missing bits that you haven't gotten throughout the show, but also, here's the plot continuing forward as well. And that was a good balance that the episode needed.
One of the big questions I had watching this episode that they haven't really explained is, how did this loop start? Because yeah. Everything seems to be in play with the loop, because you can tell it's been going on for a while. I mean, they've could have looped 10,000 times for all we know. But I was very curious, how did this loop start? And I don't know if the show is ever going to address that. But I would be interested in seeing how the loop gets started in the first place.
I think it's a very legit question, Drew, because he's his own great-grandfather, right? Or grandfather, you know, one of the two. So, like, how does that start? Really, it's a great point, Drew. How does that start? What sets that in motion in the first place? It's sort of a paradox. It's weird because they're like, nature doesn't like paradoxes. I'm like, but the whole thing is a paradox. He's his own ancestor. Yeah, I agree, Drew. And I agree with you also. I'm not entirely sure that that will be answered. And that's okay. I don't think I'll be terribly upset about that. As long as a lot of other things get tied up, I'm okay with them just sort of leaving that as time travel mumbo jumbo.
Yeah, I agree with you that on that too. It's not the end of the world if I don't find out. It'd be interesting to find out. But the show's so good that, you know, as long as they answer the other important questions that we have, and still don't know, is this loop going to be broken or not? I wouldn't be surprised if it's not broken. I wouldn't be surprised if it is broken. And that's the big mystery, is we don't know what's going to happen.
I agree with you. This is so exciting for me because it feels both options are on play. The bad ending and the like happily ever after ending feel both equally in play. Like, I wouldn't be shocked if they go back and it breaks the loop and Hillinghead isn't strangled in the cart, that Whiteman isn't hanged, that Hassan's son isn't killed by the radiation of the bomb, right? Like, that feels very much in play, that they all get new happy endings. But it also, like you said, it feels equally in play that she goes back and tries to stop the loop, but realizes that what she's doing is also part of the loop. It's going to be interesting, Drew. I don't know, because I think there's also a chance, because she mentions she thinks she's going to die when she goes back in time. And I bet she's right. I mean, ultimately, she has to be right on some level because she ain't making it back to the future. but I think it could also be not true, Drew, because I think that version of her is going to die. But there's also going to be the 2 days in the future version of her that I think is in play to pop out. And we might get I think there's an ending, Drew, where all four detectives live.
Yes, and that's possible that they all do live, and there's still a loop going on.
Yeah.
That's possible, too. It'll be very interesting to see how this plays out. All right, well, that wraps up our episode for this week. Do you have a shout-out, Cletus?
Yeah, I wanted to shout out about the original appearance of Poison Ivy. She first appeared, Drew, in 1966. I actually wasn't sure how old of a character that she was, because I feel like a lot of what has become core part of her character feels on the more modern side, with the environmentalism, and especially that being not necessarily a bad thing, feels a lot more modern. But anyway, like I said, Batman number 181 in 1966 in the story called Beware of Poison Ivy. She looks like a female version of the Jolly Green Giant on the cover.
You know what? We may have to do that as the classic cover of the week. Because that would be funny to see.
She has, like, her upper torso and face is obviously, like, normal human, like, skin tone. But the body, from the body down, it really does look like a female version of the Jolly Green Giant outfit.
That's funny. Don't be surprised if you see that as the classic cover of the week in our newsletter. All right, and for my shout-out, I'm going to shout-out about the Bat Chums podcast launching May 1st. So by the time this episode comes out, it's going to be almost May 1st. So I'm excited for that podcast to launch. Having a blast with Mike Gordon talking about the old Batman 60s series. And we're just chugging along with that. So check that out. It's not only is it a podcast, it's also going to be on YouTube. So you can see the video version if you want, which is an unedited version. So you can see all the mistakes I usually cut out in the podcast. Which Cletus is well aware of. All right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-455-8411. Leave us a message, text us, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Suicide Squad, Dream Team, Action Comics, Green Lantern War Journal, Titans, Wonder Woman, and our final episode of Bodies. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Ready to move off.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping at the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.